Okay, I'm gonna call the meeting to order. Welcome Barbara. It's 5:00. We have, our guest today is Sheriff Eric Colleen. He'll talk in a few minutes, but do we have an approval of the minutes from our last meeting? Did you get all this in your email, honey? Do you want this copy? Is there an approval of the minutes?
I'll make a motion to approve.
Okay, is there a second?
A second.
Okay, any discussion about the minutes? Okay, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Okay. Public comment, there is no members of the public today except for the sheriff, and he's the next one on our agenda. So maybe what we'll do first is go around and introduce ourselves to you, and then you can introduce yourself to us. So, Hamdi, do you want to start?
My name is Hamdi Kosar.
Okay. You want to tell him anything about you?
I'm a college student. Also, I work as a community organizer.
Okay. So, yeah. Thank you.
I'm Vicki Davis, and I own the Goodness Coffee House, and I'm newly elected council member.
So. I'm Jill Benson, and I work at Ridgewater College.
Sean Meskey, work at Ridgewater as well, and city council.
Ben, I work for DT&H, and I have a nonprofit that I run too.
Barbara Little, nurse practitioner from Woodlands, and that's about it, I guess.
Okay. And I'm Mayor Colleen, Kenai County Sheriff. So first off, thanks for having me here to give you a chance to explain my thoughts and my processes as far as the sheriff and the sheriff's office in and of itself. You know, so yes, I've got a business myself on the side as well. So I understand those of you who are also running businesses and nonprofits as well. So I thank you for your times. As far as what you want me to start out with, right. Just kind of what the direction is,
right.
What I'm hoping for the sheriff's office.
Yes, okay. I think what we'd like to hear first, I did send Sheriff Colleen the questions that we have asked law enforcement in the past, but we really are looking for what your vision is for Kenai County, for the sheriff's department, and working with the city, and all of our residents.
I will touch on just kind of some of the notes that I have, because the reason I say that is some of what I have to say will cross over to some of the questions that were asked before in the past. And if any of you watch kind of the campaign as I went on, you probably realize I think outside the box or a little bit differently when it comes to the sheriff's role and what we are supposed to do at the sheriff's office. One of the big things that I have to concentrate on first is the post-mandated stuff that is put out there by the Minnesota Peace Officers and Licensing Board for the state of Minnesota. You know, so some big things that came out since January of 2018 was implicit bias, serving a diverse community, and then also mental health training that we have to do. So when you look at those three particular subjects, we have 16 hours that I, as a law enforcement officer, have to take in a five-year period, in which I get my license renewed. So when you look at when I get my license renewed or any officer gets their license renewed, we have to have the 16 hours of training in those three areas. So when you look at the cycle and way things are occurring right now, I have some officers that are coming up due to have their license renewed this year. So with that, we have 16 hours that some of these officers have to get before their license is due here in June, which means I am cramming right now because it's a new program to make sure that all these officers get this particular training.
Can you repeat the three areas again?
Yep, crisis intervention and mental illness, implicit bias. I'll slow down for you. Got implicit bias.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then the last one is valuing a diverse community.
Okay. Thank you.
And those are mandated by our licensing board. So when you look at kind of what's happening with that particular training, I have officers that are due this year, and I have to try and squeeze them into this training. And there's actually very little of this training that is post-approved already. Alec Tech has some, and some local agencies are doing it as well. We're finding a time crunch to get everybody in and get this done. But we're going to try and do it anyways. So the ones that are a little bit further out, it's going to be a little bit easier for me to make sure that they get their hours in and get some of this stuff done. When you look at the mental health and the crisis awareness stuff, what that allows us to do as peace officers, what that training will cover, is 72-hour holds, so kind of what we can and cannot do as far as the mental health holds, as well as de-escalation of situations. You know, so when you look at kind of what's happening right now in our realm or our world for law enforcement, our jails, I hate to say this, are becoming a holding cell for the mentally ill. And there's really no solution to the issue right now. We just don't have the facilities to take care of the mentally ill that we used to. I'm not saying institutionalizing everybody is the answer, but we don't have some of those institutions that we need sometimes. And then we have individuals coming into our jails that we can tell immediately they do not belong here, but we have no place to place them. And sadly, the thing is, in our judges, our attorneys, everybody has said, well, the safest place for them is the jail. And I get that and I understand that. But when you look at what happens is they will gradually deteriorate, even inside our jail facility, even if they're medicated. You know, it's just not a life for any person. You know, you're there for a reason when you come into our jail facilities. So when you look at some of these things, we need to find a better solution. And we don't have that right now. And the only way that we're going to get it better is by legislation. So when you look at the sheriff's role, especially my role, I have to work with people like Dave Baker and everybody else to try and push for we need better mental health options rather than holding them in our jail facilities. We sadly right now are looking at adding on potentially to our jail facility what we call holding tanks. Those holding tanks are designed specifically for the mentally ill. That is sad when I'm looking at a $1.2 million project so that I can house the mentally ill because that is the safest place for them because I need one-on-one supervision of those people, you know, because they are the worst of the worst. They're smearing feces all over the cameras, the windows, and nobody will take them. They don't have beds for them. And it takes a long time for us, once we even do secure a facility, to get them into the place that they need to be into. You know, so when we look at other things that happens, our officers are sometimes not trained to the best standards or practices. Back in the day, we used to go into homes with the SWAT teams for an individual who was suicidal. Now we've realized that, you know, that wasn't the best practice. Best practice was to back off, get everybody out, don't push the issue. So some of that is trying to change the officer's mentality of go, 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 go. We got to make this arrest. We got to get this person to make it safe. When your reality of it sometimes is best is just to disengage. So what we're looking to do, there's 8-hour classes in which we can have officers attend for just some of the minor crisis intervention stuff. But then when we look at the CIT, that's a 40-hour course. It's been a while since we've had the CIT 40-hour course at our sheriff's office. It will be nice to get that back implemented for us. Sad thing is, right now, I'm working on a budget that the prior administration has already implemented. So I have to kind of find a balance in between how many people I send now, how many people I send later. So I'm concentrating on the ones that are due to expire on their post license this year. So, you know, so there is some things that we're trying to do there on that side. When we look at the implicit bias training, everybody understands you have explicit and implicit. So what that's going to do is help officers understand that, yes, subconsciously, I might have a preconceived notion of someone as to how I behave, perform, or what I do to another individual. When you look at that, for example, primarily I'll use the black community. Because when you look at the racial tensions that are created between us and a black community, especially when you have a low-income black community, sometimes you have this subconscious opinion of a person that, well, because this person's black, they live in a low-income housing area, they're more prone to violence, this, that, and the other. So what we're doing is we're training the officers to try to understand that that isn't always necessarily the case. You know, so, and with some of that is some of this cultural integration that I'm trying to do. I'm trying to get officers out into the community. We have done a really good job at the sheriff's office of enforcing the law. We do a great job of arresting, citations, this, that, and the other. My opinion is we have failed to serve the communities that we serve. And that means getting out to the community, talking and conversing with the community, getting to know the people that we serve. And like I always tell people, remember one thing, the patch that we wear on our shoulder is because they, or you, the people, allow us to serve you. You know, so I want the people to get out there, get known in the community, get to know the people that we serve, rather than just enforcement, enforcement, enforcement. You know, so that's kind of some of the things that we're looking at there. And that goes back into the community diversity as well. So when you look at different things that I've done or I'm trying to do, is I will take days and I just go have lunch in different communities. And I'll take officers with me. And it's not just me that goes out there. I take officers out there and I'll introduce them to the people that I've met while I'm out campaigning. When you look at my position as the sheriff, I do a lot of committees. I do a lot of political stuff. Politics is ugly, but in the same token, politics has a lot of power. And it has the ability, when you look at the sheriff's office, or the sheriff's position, it is a powerful position in the state of Minnesota. You know, very few people have the ability to sue the county because they don't agree with the budget or their wages. You know, and I'm elected by the people, therefore I will be here for the people. So I have a little bit different mentality than some of these other individuals who serve on these boards. They're appointed, etc., whereas I am not. I'm also nonpartisan, you know, so that, and that's a hard thing for a lot of people to understand when we look at the sheriff's position. I walk a fine line, and I bounce between what I will call political parties sometimes. And it's not because it's, I believe in whatever political party, whether it's Democrat or Republican, it's that I have to do what's in the best interest of the people. What does the United States Supreme Court say, and what does the Constitution say? You know, so that's why you'll also see with that training, when we go back to some of this ICE enforcement and things like that, that's why you'll see, you know, yes, I am pro-Second Amendment, but then I am also anti-federal infringement when it comes to ICE stuff. And when you look at some of the things that I believe in when that comes out of ICE, it also comes out of because of the Second Amendment rights that we have been given. And when we go, I'll go explain to that a little bit further later as to why we balance those things. But when we look at ICE enforcement, one of the things that I can tell you while I served at the Kenai County Sheriff's Office is I have had zero training on ICE or immigration law. Zero. What does the state of Minnesota say that we can and cannot do? Nothing. Okay? It wasn't until I left Kenai County Sheriff's Office that I had my first taste in immigration law. Now, the sad thing is, and here's the scary part, if we don't train our officers on what you can and cannot legally do, we're more likely to violate someone's rights. I don't want to violate someone's rights. So when we look at ICE in and of itself, federal enforcement is the feds' jobs. When we look at deportation, there's only two times in which we as local law enforcement officers can actually arrest someone for ICE violations. One is a deported felon who has already been shipped out of the country, then came back in. Two is if you're housing or transporting or allowing another person to come back into the United States, you know, as a mule, if you might want to call it that, we can arrest you for that violation locally. Outside of that, everything else is a federal agent's job. We have no obligation to arrest someone for ICE violations. So when you hear a lot of these different things when we talk about detainers, used to be, it was 48 hours for the detainer, in which law enforcement in the past practice was, we would hold them based upon what ICE wanted. What you saw over time is this shift in the Supreme Court rulings that said, you know what, we're not going to honor these detainers anymore, and you're actually violating their Fourth Amendment rights. And if you don't understand that as a basic concept as a law enforcement officer, how do I make sure that I don't violate that person's rights when I'm doing that? Mm-hmm. You know, so our jails got it. Yes, we don't hold people on detainers. But the troops on the ground making traffic stops, this, that, and the other, don't understand that yet. So when you look at different things that we have to educate our officers on yet, is what can and can you not ask a person when you're out on the street? Yes, if I have a traffic violation, I can proceed with a traffic violation. I can proceed with arrest, this, that, and the other. But I can't go outside the scope of that violation. As soon as I start asking questions about your immigration status, et cetera, I'm starting to walk that gray area of now am I going into the federal enforcement side of things? And I want to make sure that our officers are not doing that. You know, so, and that goes all the way back into we need to educate, and that's part of it. Our officers have not had that training yet. Yes, we've had the Somali community and Latino community come in and give talks about their culture, and that's great, but we also need to have an understanding of what we can and cannot do. You know, one of the great things that I had when I was out campaigning is I had a female party come up to me at Cinco de Mayo, and talking about a case in which I helped her. One, I knew she was an illegal immigrant, but I still prosecuted the perpetrator on her case because of the domestic violence side of things. She's now a legal citizen, but she was so happy that I never held that against her. And I just simply told her, I said, it wasn't my place or my position to worry about your immigration status. Mine was the crime that was committed at the time. It's up to ICE to do the enforcement side of things. You know, so, and what we need to do is we also have to have a education of the public when we do this. Because you'll see a lot of people they talk about when we talk about ICE stuff. The general public, you'll see there's a huge divide right now. And people don't understand that ICE violations are civil. They're not criminal. And you have a group of individuals who are hard set on the fact and they keep calling it criminal, this, that, and the other. And I have to keep continually telling people it's not criminal, it is civil. They will get their day in court just like anyone else will. You have to have due process even when you're doing ICE violations. You know, so we have this groups that are infighting and it creates a huge divide. My job isn't to create a huge divide. My job is to unite us as a community. And how I do that is going to have to be starting one with education. Not only do I have to educate my officers, but I also have to educate the public because we have this huge misunderstanding, in my opinion right now. And I think probably everybody in this room would agree with me that we do have a huge divide when it comes to ICE. So when we look at what has to happen is we have to educate people. You know, and I talked a little bit about gun rights as well as the ICE side of things. When you look at the case law and where that comes from, it comes from Pritz versus the United States. And what that was, Montana sheriffs actually sued saying, you as a federal entity cannot tell me I have to do background checks on someone because they want to get a gun. You cannot force me to do that. And the courts ruled in their favor saying, yes, that's true. You cannot do that. We are not going to make you do a Fed's job. Same thing happened when ICE started coming into play. Everyone tried to make local agencies become the enforcers, and the same thing happened. All the lawsuits that came out proved, yes, it's the same rights as in Pritz versus U.S. So when you look at kind of how I guide where my thought process is, it's based on that. United States Supreme Court ruling, U.S. Constitution, etc. Does that always make people happy? No. Do I care? No. I'm going to do what's in the best interest of the people and what I can do here locally, if that kind of helps explain that. When you look at things that occur within our jails, you know, what you will see is, I don't want to say cooperation, but I'll say more of, we will give information when it's warranted and when rulings have said, yes, you can give information. If you get arrested and you're an illegal, yes, we will inform ICE. That starts that process of your deportation. Don't get me wrong. I've had a close friend of mine who was deported. Did I like it? Absolutely not. Did I know he committed a crime? Yes, he did. Even though I may not think it was major, and you might not think it's major, he was placed in the system, the proceedings were started. When you look at that civil process system, one of the things is I had a chance to talk to a field agent one time, and we would encourage people, if you've never seen a civil process proceeding on deportations, go down to Whipple Drive and watch them. They get the same rights that you and I do when we go to the criminal court. The bad thing is, and like I always tell people and officers, we get a little bit stern or tough with people, and we forget to have empathy. One of the hardest things to remember is a lot of times is individuals have family members here. Those family members are not getting deported with them. They're staying here, and we're splitting up families. And that's the hardest thing to remember. And sometimes I always tell people, it's okay to have empathy for them. Yes, we have our role to play, but you can still have empathy for them when it comes to ICE stuff. So there is certain things that we will cooperate a little bit with ICE on. Are we going to physically go out looking for individuals? Absolutely not. If you look at the 287G, there is not a single agency yet in the United States that actually assigns officers the ability to go out and arrest people based on ICE violations. Now, I can't remember, if there might be around 28 different jails do actually do some of the processes. There's essentially two different models. There's a jail model policy, and then there's a task force. Task force is officers out on the streets physically going out trying to make arrests on ICE violations, which it is not happening right now. But then you also have jails, and I think there's 28 in the whole United States that cooperate with ICE when it comes to those violations. Minnesota, we have zero. And I think you'll see it's going to stay that way. When you look at sanctuary cities, for example, or what people call sanctuary cities, and here's the hard part, and I'm not going to lie, I get a little bit angry when I see it. I watch Facebook just like the rest of you do. But when I see people talk about sanctuary cities, and some people will get upset with me when I tell them sanctuary city is a made-up term. Sanctuary city just simply means we're abiding by the United States Supreme Court ruling. I don't have to report this to anyone. When we look at that, as part of that education process is also letting people know who use that terminology over and over again, there is no such thing as a sanctuary city. I'm abiding by what the United States Supreme Court has ruled. Do we catch a little heat sometimes as elected officials or sheriffs because of that? Yes. But that's my place to take it. So I have no fears when it comes to some of that ICE stuff. I'm trying to think what else, other questions that came up. Was there questions that you have specifically about any of the ICE stuff before I move on some of that?
Yeah, what about ICE warrants? Where's the deal with that?
Okay. When we look at ICE warrants, we do board for ICE individuals who have already started their civil process proceedings for deportation. So when you look at, I don't want to call them ICE warrants because there's very few times that a warrant's actually issued, and that's issued by the Attorney General's office. So when you look at those warrants that are issued, that's different than a detainer. A detainer is that 48-hour period in which allows ICE to investigate it. The warrant, when that actually comes down, is ICE has said we got enough probable cause to deport or most likely deport this person, which then they get held in jail. So there is a difference in those two terminologies. Okay.
Now, is that a warrant that's signed by a judge, or is that just a...
The Attorney General's office can do that one. It does not necessarily have to be by a judge on that one.
Because I know for a while ICE was putting out ICE warrants that were not signed by judges.
Correct.
Is that still happening?
I believe it still is.
Okay. In County, UI County, do you get any of those your way, or is it, what would you do if something like that came?
As of right now, the only thing that County, UI County is housing for is anyone that's got the 280 form already done and signed.
Sure, so they're in like the proceedings.
So they're in the proceedings already. We don't have anyone that has had a warrant where they get entered into there.
Okay.
So they're already started the proceedings, just so we're clear on that.
Sure.
Any other questions as far as ICE stuff?
We had a conversation before about intake forms.
when someone were to go into jail, there's a question on there about status. And we had talked about that in the past about, is that form a locally generated thing or does
yes.
it not? And based on how one answers that question determines whether or not there is contact to ICE to see if they're going to be detained.
And people didn't know that they didn't have to answer.
Correct.
And so curious about what's your opinion on that form or what your understanding of that form might be.
Yes, right. I know which one you're talking about.
Okay.
Let me see if I can find if we got anything on that. I don't want to mislead you with improper information. Some of the stuff I did ask Matt Akerson about, who is our jail administrator, for clarification purposes. Thought I had it with me.
In the past, I think the answer from the previous sheriff was that it was simply an information gathering thing to determine identification. But once that question's answered...
If I remember right, it is... The only question that we have right now that it determines your country of origin of where you were born. Does not necessarily start the proceeding process of reporting that to ICE. But I want to make sure I have exactly what Matt's answer was to that one. I swore I had it with me, but maybe I didn't bring it with.
I know that was one of the questions that was a hot button issue for many folks in the community, and that's why we brought it up on their behalf. Mm-hmm. And I know that was one that the answer left some folks a little dissatisfied, if you will.
Yeah, it was unclear still.
Right.
One of the things that Matt says, we do not ask about immigration status. We do, as a normal booking procedure, ask all inmates entering the jail their place of birth and if they are a U.S. citizen. This is asked so that, this is what his explanation was. The reason why they're asked this is the foreign national inmates are ensured access to their diplomatic respective consulates because when you look at the Eastern Bloc Europe, we are mandated to actually contact their consulate to say that they are inmates currently. Now, the reason for that is the consular notification is mandatory for the foreign national inmates for some countries under the Mandatory Notification Treaty with the United States. So that's his answer for that one. Okay, does not start the ICE proceedings.
Right, because even if someone is not a U.S. citizen, that does not mean they're here illegally.
Correct.
I mean, there's many reasons for being here, many statuses.
Correct. And when we look at, and this is exactly what you're talking about right there, when we look at immigration status, the only immigration status that we really care about is the non-documented immigration status. Because when you look at refugees, asylees, permanent non-residents, those are just to name a few, work visas, etc. So there's a lot of different reasons why someone might be here. But that process is for the notification of the consulates of those that were mandated by under treaties. Okay.
I think another thing that we were unclear on with Sheriff Hartog was that the county jail was calling ICE and telling ICE the release dates of people who were undocumented, and we were unsure if that was something that was needed.
Right. For example, there is an arrestable violation. They arrest them. They're undocumented. They say, we're holding them, they're on a 48-hour hold or whatever, like they would normally be. And if you want them, be here in 48 hours. If you don't, we're going to let them go again.
We're not sure if that call was something that was mandated, or is that...
It is not mandated. That is each individual agency's option if they choose to, or person's option if they choose to. With that being said, when you look at most of these individuals that ICE ends up getting called for. They've committed a crime, therefore the proceedings are usually started. So when you look at what happens when it is called or reported, It's not my obligation to hold that person. It's ICE obligation to make sure that they act diligently if they want me to hold that person. I can tell you right now from ICE standpoint, in the past, they used to come and get them right away or hold them on detainers. Now they're more likely just to release a person and then try and find them later. Just because the processes of what's going on has taken so much time and so long. And if we really choose to, we can find the person if we need to. Most of these people have families in the area. They're not leaving. And we want to make sure that their rights are not violated. And same with me. I'm not looking to violate someone's rights. But when you look at case law, and I probably better answer your question, when you look at case law and what case law has said, case law has said that, yes, we can have that open lines of communication. We can contact them. It doesn't forbid it, and it actually promotes it. But it's the detainers that we cannot honor.
Gotcha.
Okay.
What's your opinion on separation ordinances that other cities have done? I think Minneapolis has a separation ordinance with ICE.
When you say not having any contact?
Correct, yeah.
With them? Here's what I will tell you. I think you run a slippery slope when you start doing that. We're two law enforcement agencies. We're working together. And when you look at anyone who gets put in the ICE process is started because they committed a crime,
sure,
whether we like it or not. So they started a crime, and that's what their first contact is. When you look at anyone who hasn't committed a crime yet, we generally don't have any contact with that person until they commit a crime. It's kind of a tough spot to be in. Legally, we can do it. I don't know if I would necessarily go to the point where I'm just shut off all the walls to them.
Sure.
When you look at federally, there's some things that are nice about, you know, when agents are acting on their behalf here in Willmar. It is nice to kind of have that cohesiveness enough to understand what are they doing. And sometimes we can actually kind of oversee what are they doing.
Gotcha.
I know years ago, back in 2000 timeframe, there were some things that probably, locally, we should not have done. Assisting ICE, this, that, and the other. But when you look at the way I look at it now, it's kind of nice to be there on scene, watching what's going on. Yes, we're not going to physically make their arrests. That's ICE's project. That's their baby. But we can also be a safeguard of protecting the rights of the people who are here.
Sure.
That's another hard thing for people to understand is even though you might be here undocumented, you still have rights.
Yep.
And it's my job as a sheriff also to make sure that that person's rights are not violated. So.
Cool.
I have a question back to the mental health crisis.
Yes.
With your training with that, are you in your agency partnering with like Woodland Centers to do that training?
It's been a long time since we've had Woodland Centers come in to do any form of training. There is a business out there that's done by the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, mm-hmm, that has the CIT program, and they've partnered with the Minnesota Sheriff's Association and MPOA, which is the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, and they do CIT training. But I can't tell you when the last time was that we had someone from Woodlands come out and do any training.
Because quite possibly they know a lot of the repeat offenders, for
absolutely,
lack of a better word.
Yep, they hear my name quite a bit. Who writes your meds?
Yeah.
Barbara?
Yeah.
I need my meds. Yeah. And in my experience has been very positive, with the mental health. It's a frustrating situation. The trick is the people that I see, mm-hmm, they're established. They get some meds. Whether they're taking them or not, they will take them when they're in jail. But it's the ones who fall out of that, the ones that we don't even know. We don't ever get. They don't come to see us. And so that, but for the most part, I've had a pretty good, I feel pretty good about it.
And they're ending up in the ER and stuff. But I still think there would be some value in partnering with your local mental health agency who are the experts locally to...
Yes, I would agree with that.
Who have seen all the fallout of not having WRTC anymore, and, you know.
What, and I think our CEO would be willing to listen to a conversation about doing something. I don't know what kind of trainings they did in the past. I've been here for 6 years, but so anything before that, I don't know.
It was a lot of what will you accept, what will you not? Do you have the beds? Is it local versus non-local?
Yeah.
You know, one of the things, and I don't, maybe you could reach out to your CEO and probably start this food for thought. Meeker County, for example. I worked part-time in Meeker County before coming here. Great thing about leaving your job before you become sheriff is going to work for other agencies to find out what they do. When I went to Meeker, one of the things that they did is they have Dr. Ho, that actually he is a doctor, but not only that, he's also a police officer. And one of the things that he does, he works for HCMC. And so what they did is they started a pilot project out in Meeker County. And it'd be great if we could replicate that here. What he has is a community service officer. And what this guy does is he is a paramedic. But not only that, he also functions as a first-line defense before the person ends up into the family services portion of their human services. So what they do is anytime they get someone who might be elderly or someone who's not taking their meds, this, that, and the other, one of the first things that he does is he goes in Monday morning with the people that he sees as violators over the weekend who might not be on their meds, had a mental health issue, a breakdown, et cetera. And what he does is he just goes door to door to door with those people. And he's that first line of communication to start is this a family services issue where we now have to get our human services division involved, or is this something that I can handle and kind of, and he's got unique ways of setting up a med tray, this, that, and the other for different people as to what can they do to keep it from becoming a point where he ends up getting placed or she gets placed somewhere. You know, so it would be kind of unique to see if maybe that would be something down the line that we could try to figure something out with. I can reach out to Brian Cruz and ask him, hey, how do you guys exactly do this?
Yeah.
You know, that's something that they do.
Maybe like 5 or 10 more minutes for you.
Okay.
To wrap up.
Okay. All right.
I mean, it's really great. We have like 2 other things. I'm sorry.
Yep.
I have one quick question about sexual assault.
Yes.
I've read so much, right, and started, you know, month after month about the low solve rates in Minnesota of sexual assault victims. And so how do we stand in terms of sexual assault victims here?
I think when you look locally and even nationally, Minnesota's doing a dang good job compared to other states. Now, with that being said, we have a unique system in place right now. I know there's some grants being offered right now for sex assault issues because nationally we're seeing a huge issue. Locally, we have a process put into place where as soon as a person decides that they want to report a rape or a sexual assault, we have what's called SANE nurses that start that process of going through and collecting the evidence in a less invasive procedure. When you look at cops, for example, deputies and cops were primarily males. So it's very abnormal because when you look at most crim sex, it's usually a female. So it creates a very awkward environment when you have a female who wants to report a crim sex and it ends up being a male officer that comes to deal with you. Because usually the assailant is a male. So what we try to do is we try to get the victim's advocate group started right away, a guardian, that comes in and kind of helps that person with that process. Now, the unique system that we have right now is when we do these SANE kits, a nurse does the procedure and they hold on to that kit at the hospital. It does not necessarily get released to law enforcement, hence where some of our problems are becoming. So you might have a rape victim that says, I did the kit, I don't want nothing done, hold on to it. Never gets reported to law enforcement, you know. And so when you look at what happens, then it creates this awkward dilemma. Hospitals are holding on to these rape kits. Well, how long do they hold on to these rape kits? You know, so when you look at how long are they actually holding on to them versus the evidence in and of itself, is it deteriorating, et cetera, there is a time limit in which you want to get this stuff sent off, processed. My opinion, I don't think it's conducive to having a rape kit sitting in a hospital. My opinion, it should be collected, sent to the BCA, processed anyway so you can get the DNA analysis. But, you know, here you are, you have a victim that's saying, no, I don't want you to do anything with it. Locally, anytime that we've had someone say, process it, it's done. We have policies and procedures in place to ensure that those kits are brought to the BCA, that they are tested, and they are done. You know, so for the most part, locally, we don't have issues. But I can't speak nationally.
We have talked this about this back in election. Are you guys still looking at the cultural liaison that, you know, mediates the Hispanic cultural liaison and the Somali cultural liaison in the...
Yes. When you look at, and here's what I'm going to be honest with you, what we need to do. When you look at our populace right now, law enforcement, we have very few Hispanics and Somalis within our agency. Zero dispatchers, maybe two law enforcement officers that are Latino. When you look at female, you're looking maybe three female officers. So we have this huge gap that we're not filling. So one of the things that would be nice to do is start some form of liaison program so that we can get that going. Hard part of that is funding. Especially if I'm going to do it as a paid position, I have to first get county board approval in order to do that. And that's a position approval that I have to get done as well. When you look at some of these grants and stuff that I handed you beforehand, on that we're relying on goodness of hearts of people within our community to start reaching out to everybody else. But it would be nice when you look at positions and things like that, and I'm going to be the first to tell you this, from the inside looking out and the outside looking in at one point in time, our agency suffers at recruitment and retention. And that recruitment also means to the minority communities. So hopefully when I get my first round of applicants again, we can change the way that we do business. So it'd be nice, though, if, yes, we can. Law enforcement altogether, we're getting a bad, when you look at applicants, period, we have a small number. When you look at minorities, we get even a smaller number, and a lot of times none, in a primarily white world. To say the least, when it comes to law enforcement.
So is that one of your priorities, is to get more of your agents to look reflective of our community?
Of our community.
Kanduah County?
Correct.
Okay. Of course, that should be true in the schools, right? And
yes.
Yes, and that doesn't happen.
All the Latino teachers in Wilmer, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So.
And, you know, sometimes it's hard to recruit in those communities. You know, just because, let's just say the black community, for example. I know, because my brother-in-law is black, you know, so I can say this openly. And he'll be the first to tell you, his experiences with law enforcement were terrible. So you think he's want to become a cop? No. He's like,
right.
No
right.
Way. You know, to him, we're evil. You know, his mind's changed a little bit now that he's gotten to know me. But when you look at cops back in Chicago, he still looks at them as evil. And we have to change our culture. So when you look at the climate and character of law enforcement, I said this even when I was campaigning, I have a climate and character in our sheriff's office that I have to change. One of the things that I have learned through politics is rumor mills. Rumor mills will destroy you. And if they don't know the truth, they'll make it up. And cops are the worst. And I'm trying to change that. I'm trying to change that culture and that climate. And I always been telling people, if you didn't hear it from me, it's probably not true. And that's a hard thing to fix. And that happens anywhere you're at, any business you're at. We have a bunch of people who like to babble, like to be on the in. And gossip, no different than your workplaces.
I feel like there's a coffee and donuts joke in there somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. So do you have one top priority that a year from now you hope happens, that you hope is true? I mean, what would be one thing that would be at the top of your list if you come back here in February of 2020 that this has changed in the Kanduah County Police department?
I've got a few. I won't just say one, but okay. I've got a few. But if I had to say the top biggest priority is going to be some of the reform in the jail program. When you look at our jail programs, for example, hard to believe, but clergy, we're not able to have face-to-face meetings with our staff, or not our staff, our inmates. And part of that is, you know what the sad thing about that is the breakdown in communications between administration and clergy. It can happen. You just have to go through the background check process, go through your vetting process as a clergy person, and that can happen. When we look at some of the recidivism that we have because of the drug issues, Fortress, for example, here in town, mm-hmm. has already reached out to me. Cecil is willing to work with us to get the same programs going here that Renville County has already. And it cost us nothing to do it. Why wouldn't we do it? The problem is egos get in the way. I have no problems doing things because I don't own it. Those things are because of the people that make that happen. My goal is to take recidivism and cut it down. I don't want to see the same people over and over in our jail system because that's who we're seeing. Not that I want to see new faces, but you know, it's the ones, the same families. And we all know it. You see it probably even in your own profession. It's the same person over and over, or the same families that re-offend. And that's what I'm looking to stop. So when we look at the jails, jail has been kind of a big priority for me. But with that being said, all the other subjects that we talked about here tonight, there's no reason why we can't accomplish any of those in that first year. Am I crunched for time? Yes. I got Julie Weifels that I appointed as my chief deputy. I have to fill her spot as sergeant. That could create a domino effect in some other things. And then I plan on appointing two individuals as community crime prevention officers and policing officers. I, as the sheriff, can only do so much. But if I have people that I delegate things to, we can get a lot more done more efficiently. And we used to have a community policing officer position, and as she'll tell you, her position kind of went null and void almost 10 years ago. She's let a lot of her things lapse just because the last administration didn't care about that. And that's why I always tell people we got to get back into the service of the people rather than the enforcement. And that's my goal as the sheriff. One of the things that you'll see is I don't wear a white shirt, because I'm no different than the rest of the guys and gals out there working the street. I'm one of them. I understand them. I support them. I started out as a road officer. Even as a sheriff, I'll continue to think like a road officer. And I'm there to support them and vice versa. And yes, you will see me taking them out into the community and introducing them to the people that I know, because I know ultimately I am replaceable. 4 years from now, I may not be the sheriff, but hopefully if someone decides to run against me, it's someone who has the same thoughts and ideals that I do that keeps the agency going in the same direction that I wanted it to go. So,
thank you very much.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you. Thank you so
much. We appreciate it. We very much appreciate it.
Before you go, I just feel like, you know, could there be a next step between us and the Sheriff's Department? And I'm just wondering, and maybe you guys have already mentioned it or you've already kicked it around, but is there a way that we could partner in, like, hosting a forum about ICE issues?
Absolutely, we can.
We could have it in the community, and it's like, we just have that and just clear everything up, because it is such a huge thing that everybody has no clue about. Yep. So.
Right, because education is one of our charges as well. Mm-hmm. So, yes, we would love to partner with you on that.
Yeah, we've talked in the past, and first of all, let me say, this is the first time I've met you, Sheriff Holian, and I'm impressed with what I'm hearing, and I think... in the past, we tried to iron out some of these things about ICE in particular, and we've tried to put out informational pieces that are in different languages to reach different folks as well. So any kind of a forum that could be done would be, I think, go a very long way. There's a lot of folks in this county who are terrified to report any crime, thinking they're going to somehow be implicated, deported, etc., for just being undocumented. And I will tell you, one of our other roles is to advocate that if someone thinks that their rights were violated, the Human Rights Commission, we would make complaints to the Human Rights Commission for the state. We've never had to do that, and if the things you're talking about come to fruition, we will not have to do that. And I very much appreciate that.
Biggest thing, in my opinion, is transparency. So when you look at law enforcement, we have a tendency to be very guarded. But we have to live in a glass house. You know, living in a glass house for law enforcement prevents those things from happening. The complaints, the lawsuits, etc. And like I always tell people, part of my campaign, what I always told people is strive for excellence. Perfection's unattainable. Excellence, we may screw up. You know? And don't get me wrong, I might make a decision at some point in time, I screw up. I just have to be able to admit it and eat it and say, yep, that was a mistake on my part, and I own it. Hard part is we as law enforcement have a tendency not to admit when we're wrong. And that's part of the problem. And we can't be afraid. Sometimes, yes, we will get sued. Sometimes we will get complaints. It's the nature of the beast doing the job that we do. And that's why when you talk about your jobs, for example, here, yes, that is to hold us accountable for our actions.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I look forward to doing something like that. That'd be great.
Cool. Mm-hmm. Cool.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Yep, absolutely.
I'll talk to my boss tomorrow.
Okay, that sounds great.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Okay. The next thing on the agenda, the GAR update, we had just a great group from Wilmer that was going. Vicki was going, I was going, Sean was going, another instructor from the college, and Sarah Swedberg from the city, and it got canceled. So that's the GAR update.
So has it been rescheduled?
They're working on
rescheduling. It will be rescheduled.
Right.
Bad vortex. So.
I know, right. I know. So... Yeah, but I mean, we were all thrilled that there were six of us that were going to be going and attending
And I will add that the city has paid the money for participation.
Nice.
But we are looking still to expand those partnerships beyond the city's contribution, that if we can find partners at the college with the goodwill, anything else, if they can make monetary pieces to where even the people's time can be reimbursed for travel and so on, and the transference of the information gleaned back to those organizations, I think that would be great. And I think there's going to be some community work that comes from that. So those organizations, we may be working on it here in Wilmer.
Right.
And so I haven't made the ask yet, but it will be coming.
Mm-hmm.
That if we're going to make a coalition, that everybody has some skin in the game for that coalition, and to make it as productive as we can for Wilmer.
Right. And Goodwill, I mean, they've already approved my time and my mileage, you know, so that's fine. They're fine with me, so I'm on there. So anyway, so that's update. Jill had an item that came to me today.
So I had a student in my Composition 2 class talk to me about how she works at 4th Avenue Homes, and I've underlined what I think is the most pertinent part. It sounds like it's sort of terrible enough anyway with some of the clients there, right? But the problem is this, and I've underlined it. 4 months ago, her boyfriend got hired, Oscar, and he's already getting paid $1 more than her starting pay. At the group home the boyfriend has worked at, he was asked by the man, the video game, blah, blah, blah. Okay, when I asked HR about the pay discrepancy, she told me different houses have different pay. That'd be understandable if my house that my boyfriend works at wasn't the house I was first trained in. However, when I was trained at that house, there was more human waste to clean up, while now there's none. It would make sense if it was like the crisis home he works for as well. That's beside the point. Even though I was hired a year ago, I'm still being paid 25 cents less an hour than my boyfriend who was hired 4 months ago. Okay? So she went to HR and they blew her off. What can she do?
I would say that is employment. I mean, it would be employment law thing, wouldn't it?
I would imagine. But there's a
there would be several questions that one would have. I will say on the surface, I think I understand exactly what you're saying here. We don't know, are there performance pieces included? Are there other pieces that we don't know that's worth investigating, I would say.
Right. Does
But right now,
Did he have more experience?
I have more questions.
Yeah. You know, did he have more experience coming in?
Or? No. Okay. And I know him from another class. And he's a very nice person, right? They're both fine, great students. But he does not have more experience in this line of work because it's a job that's new to him as well, he told me. He started it when he had me last semester.
So their entry level was at a par. Skills, requirements, job description.
Did one of them negotiate and ask for more?
She went to HR and said, "What's up?"
No, I mean when they started.
No, I don't think so.
No, so he just started with more.
I don't think they often work the same.
I mean, does one work overnight and one work days? Maybe.
I don't know.
Because the other thing, too, sometimes with, you know, agencies will do things that they'll try to raise wages, you know, to catch up. And unfortunately, people who are starting are getting paid more wages than people who've been there a while. And then they're trying to, like, back and catch up. I mean, I know we've had that at times, too, where the starting wage is this. But it's like, wait a minute, we still have people making this. And then they're trying to get them up. But they're not that far above, and I mean it's a huge problem.
Does legal aid deal with any employment law at all? I'm just wondering if that would be a question for them. I mean, if she is willing to pursue it with them.
Right.
Hey, she's gutsy, right? She brought it up. She's only known me for a couple weeks, right?
Yeah.
And I perked right up, like.
Because the other thing too,
she's
the minimum wage
for sure.
Went up again in January, you know, so, and I would think that this agency, as big as it was, are they paying federal minimum wage or Minnesota minimum wage? Minnesota minimum wage is higher than federal minimum wage, but it just went up in January again. Minnesota is now $9.86.
Okay.
And I think is federal still $7.25 or is it $7.50?
I don't know.
We pay Minnesota because it's higher.
Well,
but
I would say Nate's comments are very well stated that we advocate and educate.
Mm-hmm.
Investigate is not one of those things.
Right.
Right.
But to advocate for them to go to the proper place for the investigation is absolutely
because I have no idea what to tell.
Right.
Because
right.
I remember we had one of these issues long ago with a different company in town, and that person went in on our behalf and said they're investigating, and it's like we said, that is not what we're in that business.
Right.
And so I like the sending them to the proper places to get that information, and if it is found that there is indeed a legal stance, we can certainly advocate at that point, for sure.
Do you think I send her to legal aid?
I think
to
it's
check
a,
it out.
Good,
but those
I don't know
are
if
some
it will
of
have
the
questions,
too,
it will be a,
I think that she could ask. You know, that those are, I mean, all the questions that came up.
Because so I can tell her about your, you know, this sometimes even the more recent people are earning a higher. But still,
unfortunately,
when she went to HR... They should have said
to be brushed off.
Oh, right.
Mm-hmm. At least explain it.
Right. 25 cents an hour, right? It gulls her. But would it really have cost them that much then to go? Oh, you're right. Right.
Here's 50 cents.
Let's look into it.
Yes.
Right.
This might be another issue. There's a lot of issues in this paper.
Right.
But the issue of if I was a guardian and I read that. At the group home my boyfriend works at, he was asked the man conducting the interview if he plays video games and told my boyfriend he can play video games while working because it is a chill house. I'd be pissed if I was a guardian or a social worker.
Oh,
and I
listen,
that was
I don't want to live in a divine house ever.
Yeah.
And I don't want to live in a nursing home either. My students,
right?
Again and again and again.
Right.
So
I have one other thing.
Okay, for the council members,
someone came to me about that small cities grant that was the article that was in the paper last week.
Yes.
About and wondering when the public hearing for that is, because the idea they had were some. Is maybe asking for some accessibility things at the fairgrounds and making it a little bit more accessible for elderly, people with disabilities, things like that. So wanting to know when that hearing is for that.
I would refer that to Ike Holland.
Okay.
I know Janelle is obviously out of the country, I believe, right now on vacation.
Yeah, she's in Mexico.
So Ike Holland would be your contact.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. It was in that article.
Oh, was it? Okay. Okay. And then our next meeting is March 19th. Okay.
I'll forget about that one too.
What?
I'll text you.
I'll rely on Ben to text me. I had it on my phone.
Okay. It is 6 o'clock. Do you have a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Is there a second? Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Okay, we're adjourned.